how you got to startups and how'd you find out that it was a viable career path?
Oh, wow. So I grew up a grandson of a steelworker, the son of a Presbyterian minister. So I was at the low end of the middle class. And when I graduated high school, the steel industry tanked and everybody left town. And I was seeing some people be successful in other cities. I would read Forbes magazine. I would read Fortune magazine, and they would talk about the entrepreneurs. And I would think to myself, why not? Why couldn't I pursue that? And so it was something that stuck in my head through my undergraduate education. And I was actually getting a PhD in physics at Georgia Tech. And I realized that the tech side wasn't the side that I would be the best at. It was at the selling side. And so I decided then to be an entrepreneur. And that led me back to Carnegie Mellon, where at the time it was pre-internet. You couldn't learn to be an entrepreneur on the internet. You had to go to business school to be an internet. And Carnegie Mellon had one of the best business schools in the world. And it had one of the first entrepreneurship programs in the world. In 1971, the president of the university, Dick Seyert, hired Jack Thorne to start the first entrepreneurship program at any university. So that reputation led me here. And from that point, I launched my entrepreneurial career.
Interesting. So what was the first company that you founded?
Yeah. So a guy named Don Jones was a successful entrepreneur in the Pittsburgh area. And he gave $1 million in 1989, which was a lot of money in 1989, to found the Don Jones Center for Entrepreneurship at the Tepper School of Business. I was very fortunate to be a student at...
You're listening to Public Affairs on WRCT Pittsburgh.
We could all use a little help navigating the news these days. The Consider This podcast wants to give you a hand. 6 days a week, we'll help you make sense of the day's biggest news story and what it means for you in less than 15 minutes. Listen now to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
From KUT and KUTX Studios.
From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio. This is In Black America.
So as the head of diverse segments, my responsibilities are to grow home ownership opportunities for underserved communities. And when we say underserved communities, we talk about low and moderate income communities and low and moderate income people. So those customers who make less than 80% of the median income for that area. I'm also accountable for growing diverse lending, ethnically diverse lending, across all income segments, because while we know there's a home ownership gap in our country, we equally have a gap in serving affluent minorities. So it's not just low income minorities, it's affluent minorities that also may have similar challenges to attaining a home.
Chuck Bishop, Senior Vice President, Head of Diverse Segments, Wells Fargo Home Lending. As a child growing up in Washington, D.C., he watched his mother live in the same apartment for 42 years and paid a total of $907,000 in rent. His path to home ownership is personal because he didn't live in a house until he became an adult and bought his own. At Wells Fargo, Bishop's job is to expand home ownership opportunities for the underserved communities, which include people of color and individuals with low to moderate incomes. Home ownership is a key pillar of the American dream. It's a pathway to financial success and a source of stability in our communities. Also, owning a home is one of the most important pathways to wealth creation, providing families with a foundation for improving their financial position across generations. I'm Johnny O'Hanson, Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, Home Ownership with Chuck Bishop, Senior Vice President, Head of Diverse Segments, Wells Fargo Home Lending, In Black America.
You know, we've got some historic challenges. You got to think about, there was years ago, prior to the Fair Housing Act, discrimination was legal. We also were at a point in our history where the federal government would not insure a community where there were black and brown residents. So you think about after World War II, when a lot of veterans came back and obtained VA loans, well, it was a challenge for African-American soldiers to get those loan programs because they couldn't get those loans insured. So you think about there are systemic issues that were policy created, and then even today you have challenges with rising home prices, inequitable income. You think about homes in typically minority communities, you don't see a lot of homes for sale as much as you do in other communities because we've got institutional investors who buy the homes, or you have commercial entities who buy those homes and turn them into long-term rentals.
As head of Wells Fargo's Home Lending Diverse Segments, Chuck Bishop has built a decade-long career helping people of color purchase homes. The rate among African-American home ownership sits at 44% and has only bumped up by 0.4% in the last decade. This is easily 29 percentage points less than white Americans at 72.7%. As Bishop sees it, home ownership is critical for a lot of reasons. For one, we know that home ownership is the beginning of the creation of wealth. Most Americans use their home ownership journey as a pathway to legacy opportunities that some family pass their property to their heirs. It is often the biggest purchase that many people make. Studies have shown that children who grow up in homes where their parents are homeowners often do better in school, have a higher graduation rate, and a lower truancy rate than children of parents who rent. Recently in Black America spoke with Chuck Bishop.
Philadelphia, I was only there for a year, so I don't remember much about Philly. But in Washington, D.C., you know, I'm old enough to experience a lot of things, you know, post-civil rights activities. I remember the riots in Southeast Washington. I had the pleasure of opening one of the first bank branches east of the Anacostia River after the riots. I remember, you know, all of the activities behind elections. I remember, and I still see all the tourism here. So growing up in the D.C. area has a lot of advantages, and you get a lot of exposure to a lot of culture and history.
I understand. So what particularly sparked that interest for you to be involved in the financial service industry?
You know, I wish, John, I could tell you there was some grand plan that came together for me and worked out the way I started. But I went to college and was a business major, knew I wanted to work with money or in revenue some way, and I wanted to work with people. Came out and was hired by a bank right out of college, and thus kind of became my journey in financial services. Started in traditional retail banking, branch banking, and then changed into the mortgage business later on. But I got to tell you, John, this might be part of my heredity. My mother told me long ago that her parents met at a bank. So my maternal grandmother and grandfather met when they were 15, working at a bank in Lawrenceville, Virginia, where unfortunately they couldn't even go through the front door. They were domestics working at night as cleanup. And that's where they met and fell in love and got married. So you might say bank is kind of in my blood.
You were born into the industry.
Apparently so.
What college did you attend?
Virginia Tech.
Now, I understand that while you were growing up, your mom never owned a home. She lived in an apartment for 42 years?
My mother lived in an apartment much longer than that. My mother has rented for more than 60 years.
Mm-hmm.
I never lived in a home until I bought one.
Mm. Tell us about that growing up in an apartment and your mother never made the transition to home ownership. Did she just didn't want to own a home, or what was it?
You know, John, growing up and even early in my financial services career, I didn't ask the question. You know, my mother and father divorced when I was really young. And I would tell you by the time I was 10, I had lived at six different rental places. So we moved a lot early in my life. Later on, she became a bit more stable with her residence, and she moved because of either career growth and other opportunities. But when she settled down, her last apartment she lived in for 42 years, that one apartment, so that's the number you got, the 42 years. She has dementia now, and unfortunately I had to move her from that apartment 2 years ago into an assisted living facility. But it was then that I was going through years and years of kind of records when I realized that, you know, my mother has rented for more than 60 years. And when I started looking at how much she's paid, John, it's close to, at this point, close to $1 million that she's paid in rent. That's money that she's paid to use somebody else's property. That's money that she didn't create her own wealth with. She didn't get her own equity. She doesn't have debt as a reserve today. that's money that paid somebody else's mortgage all those years.
At Wells Fargo, what are your responsibilities currently?
So as the head of diverse segments, my responsibilities are to grow home ownership opportunities for underserved communities. And when we say underserved communities, we talk about low and moderate income communities and low and moderate income people. So those customers who make less than 80% of the median income for that area. I'm also accountable for growing diverse lending, ethnically diverse lending, across all income segments, because while we know there's a home ownership gap in our country, we equally have a gap in serving affluent minorities. So it's not just the low income minorities, it's affluent minorities that also may have similar challenges to attaining a home.
What are some of the hurdles that people of color have to overcome to become homeowners?
You know, John, one of the biggest hurdles that we've got to overcome is the myth that we believe. The myth that we believe around having to have perfect credit, having to have a 20% down payment, having to have, you know, X number of years at the job. Those things need to be, you know, fully understood. Today, education is what's really important for customers who decide whether they want to own or not. Not owning a home shouldn't be because you don't think you have access. There are so many programs today. There's so many resources available. You know, I highly encourage people to reach out to a HUD-approved nonprofit counseling agency to begin the conversation about where I am in my life journey as far as financially being prepared, and then understanding where do I need to go and get to before I buy. Don't just go hire a realtor or go see a realtor right away because you saw a home on Zillow and you think you want to buy it. You need to really find your money before you start to find a home.
Are there any special programs that Wells Fargo offer that's similar to other lending institutions offer for people of color to become homeowners?
Absolutely. In 2023, we created a special purpose credit program specifically targeted to help purchase homes. So the special purpose credit program allows us to help homeowners who are buying in certain communities. We provide them with a down payment. One of the biggest challenges for people of color when it comes to buying a home is either the debt to income, meaning the monthly payment is too high, or two, the LTV is too high, meaning the amount they're borrowing versus the value of the property is too high. At Wells Fargo, we look to help eradicate some of those impediments to buying a home. So creating a down payment assistance grant where we are gifting to the recipient $10,000 helps to lower that payment. It not only lowers the payment, it lowers the LTV. So customers move into that home with equity and with a lower payment, thus getting rid of one of the challenges that's the biggest hurdle, and that's, you know, the affordability piece. As you know, interest rates are a little higher than people typically want to buy with, and home prices are steadily increasing. So we can't control the price of homes, but we can make a contribution towards the affordability piece, and that's where the Home Buyer Access product comes into play. We've also created another program called the Dream Plan Home Mortgage, which is a mortgage program that has a more competitive feature to it, allowing it to compete against government programs and other traditional mortgage programs. And it also has a closing cost companion with it that can provide $5,000 in closing costs for customers in selected markets.
How did people of color become so underserved in the home ownership arena?
Wow. That's a question that could take a lot of time to answer. You know, we've got some historic challenges. You got to think about, there was years ago, prior to the Fair Housing Act, discrimination was legal. We also were at a point in our history where the federal government would not insure a community where there were black and brown residents. So you think about after World War II, when a lot of veterans came back and obtained VA loans. Well, it was a challenge for African-American soldiers to get those loan programs because they couldn't get those loans insured. So you think about, there are systemic issues that were policy created. And then even today, you have challenges with rising home prices, inequitable income. You think about homes in typically minority communities. You don't see a lot of homes for sale as much as you do in other communities because we've got institutional investors who buy the homes, or you have commercial entities who buy those homes and turn them into long-term rentals. So we don't have the same turnover of properties, which means there's less available to buy. It challenges the affordability that way. So it's no, there's no one place that creates this problem. There are so many different avenues that are creating headwinds. We've got work to do in the policy space. We've got work to do in the product space. And we've got work to do in the inventory space.
In my job, I get a chance to travel a lot and observe over time and over years that the homes built in majority communities are not the same type of homes built in people of color and brown community. Am I not seeing that correctly?
I don't know if I can validate that statement necessarily. I think you'll find builders that are going to build according to the income levels of the market that they can support. They're not going to build a home that $800,000 house in the community where there's $60,000 median income levels all around. They need to be able to move the property. So what I do think you'll find is you don't find enough inclusionary housing, meaning where they do build higher end homes, they should build equally appealing homes of lesser price. So if you've got that $800,000, you know, five bedroom home, you can build a $400,000 home that looks very much like it, but smaller and maybe not as sophisticated with the amenities, but a home that is equally, you know, amenable to the purchaser, because there's got to be an entry point. And it can't be that we build all these communities that are on the fringe of affordability where people in the neighboring areas can't afford. There's got to be greater inclusionary housing, but it's also got to be more developers creating loans at the entry level prices. You know, that's the bigger challenge I see. Most of the new construction is at such a high level that people can't afford. And when the people who own homes, for instance, myself, I'm not going to sell my home anytime soon. So if I'm not moving because interest rates are high or higher, my house doesn't become available for the next person behind me who may be able to afford this home, because I'm not going to move to the next one. There's a little bit of a cycle where you've got to have people moving out of those homes they bought 10, 15 years ago to buy the next one that frees up that real estate, because there isn't as much development in that space. And people aren't moving because rates are a little higher than they want to buy today.
Speaking of 10 or 15 years ago, 2008, there was that housing crisis. How did that affect people of color, and how did that affect you doing what you do?
Wow, that was a wake-up call for the industry. I think for people of color, it's unfortunate because many people were taken advantage of by getting loans that were, they were called subprime loans. And they were exotic mortgages that had adjustments or potentially balloon payments that would make it, that made it unaffordable. Again, when we started the conversation, John, the first thing I said was get educated, understand the nuances of the mortgage, and make sure you know what you're getting into. And then there were much, less stringent credit policies in place. So there were people getting homes that, you know, had low incomes, but they got it at a lower payment with the assumption that their incomes are going to jump in 3 to 5 years to be able to cover the increase in payment. And the reality knows that doesn't happen. Incomes don't jump significantly in 3 to 5 years. So it's not a program that Wells was deeply involved in. We never were a subprime lender like that. But again, you'll see there are a lot of black and brown communities where those loans were used disproportionately higher than other communities. And when those loans don't repay, you'll see a disproportionate impact to those communities due to the foreclosures.
You're listening to In Black America with John L. Hanson, Jr. We'll be back in just a moment. If you're just joining us, I'm John L. Hanson, Jr., and you're listening to In Black America from KUT Radio. And we're speaking with Chuck Bishop, Senior Vice President, Head of Diverse Segment, Wells Fargo Home Lending. Mr. Bishop, how assuring when customers come in and see a gentleman like you if they're a person of color?
So are you asking me about me being black in my role? Does that make the customer more comfortable? Is that?
Yes.
Okay.
A person of color will be more, they're already apprehensive from the get-go,
sure,
but seeing
sure.
you and explaining the process, do it make them more comfortable?
Yeah. I think what's first and foremost, which should happen, is the person should look for competency. I think diversity is critical in all roles, at all levels of the bank. So whether it's, you know, at our executive levels or it's at our entry level, diversity is critical there, particularly as it relates to being able to understand language gaps and things like that. So that's a must. But with respect to executing a transaction, I would tell you that my bigger concern, more so than race, is acumen. I have to have somebody who is the professional in the business. And, you know, in my role, being black is an advantage because of my life experiences, because of the diverse values that I have and bring to the table in my experiences. But But what's more important is I couldn't do this job unless I were a seasoned mortgage professional. You know, I spent time in the secondary market to understand the pooling of loans, to understand how to measure risk, to understand all those other things. So when it comes into selecting a mortgage professional, you really want somebody who's well vested in not just the industry, but understanding what opportunities are out there for you. Do they understand the community loan programs that are available? Do they understand what the competitive landscape looks like? Do they understand where there's opportunities to lean into state and local government programs? So those are the things that are really important. It's often reassuring when you can relate to that person because they look like you, and we need to be representative of the community that we do business in. But I would tell you, it's equally as important to make sure that that person is competent, because at the end of the day, it's your money.
When should one start thinking about purchasing a home and some of the steps they need to include to get to that point?
John, it's never too early. That question is really dependent upon where they are in their kind of financial journey. For some people, that might be 8 or 9 months. For some people, it could be 60, 90 days. If you're even thinking about buying, I highly encourage people to start to get educated. You can go to the Wells Fargo website, wellsfargo.com/mortgage-education, and you can use the tools there to understand how much can I qualify for, what programs are available, you know, what does my credit look like. You need to start to do some of the discovery work early, again, so you're not surprised. You can work with a nonprofit agency so they can run you through a hypothetical program to see where your challenges may or may not be. You can use one of the many credit scoring apps to kind of check your own credit and make sure there are no issues in your credit. Again, the last thing you should do is run to a real estate agent. I love my real estate agent professionals, but a real estate agent's not going to want to put you in their car unless they know you're qualified to buy this home. So that's why I say find your money first, do the work with a nonprofit agency. They are unbiased. They don't have any allegiance to a specific lender. They're going to counsel you on the best situation for you as an individual, and then they will give you options of many lenders to go and choose. Or you can start with a Wells Fargo loan officer who will sit and work with your situation. And if you're ready, proceed to help you with a pre-approval. If you're not ready, we can introduce you to one of those nonprofit counseling entities that can help you get ready. And I tell you, I don't ever like to tell a customer no. I might have to tell a customer not now, but I shouldn't ever tell you no.
As a 30-year veteran of this industry, what are some of the good things you've seen thus far?
Yeah, you had to say the 30-year part, huh, John? So you just put it out there.
Yeah, I had to put that there.
I've seen some amazing things in our industry. You know, I would tell you the creation of the Special Purpose Credit Program to actually acknowledge the historical challenges to underserved people, specifically people of color, and to say that, you know, there was no equity, so we need to provide an equitable opportunity for homeownership. That's huge. To see today banks cooperate. I actually work with, you know, what people think are my competitor entities, but they are actually peers. We can't overcome this racial inequity in housing as Wells Fargo alone. So I work on many industry task force. I work with governmental agencies to collectively come together and try to solution for this homeownership gap. Today, the difference between African-American homeownership and white homeownership is almost 30 percentage points. Wells Fargo can't do that by itself. We are a leader and have been a leader, one of the largest lenders to people of color for the last decade, but we need to have help in this battle. So the one thing I'm happy to see today is more collaboration across the financial services and across the government agencies, because we're all kind of rolling up our sleeves to a greater degree trying to eradicate this gap in homeownership.
Other than spending money, your money wisely, why is it important for one to own a home?
Well, I'll give you back to that example we started with. Let's talk about my mother. She spent almost $1 million in rent. I looked at the last unit she lived in, condo that she rented for somebody else. That condo would have sold for $65,000 the year she started renting it. The day she moved out, it was worth almost $300,000. So if you think about that, she would have paid for it clearly in that 42 years and had 12 years of savings. So she would have that $250,000 plus the 12 years of no mortgage payment. If you look at that right there, there's $300,000 that she doesn't have aside from the $1 million that she already paid. So the benefits of home ownership give you a piece of real estate that you can sell at a later date. That real estate is valuable for a lot of reasons. It finances your kids' college education. It provides equity to pay off other debts. In many cases, it's provided a jumpstart for small businesses who need some cash to run a small business. We also have tax benefits. So there's so many different things that happen financially because of home ownership, and then you have the social benefits. You know, it's been shown that children have less childhood disease. They do better in school. There's less teen pregnancy. There's less truancy. There's more local government involvement. The social benefits of home ownership are equally as beneficial as the financial benefits. So, you know, this home ownership piece, while it's what I do, I wouldn't push everybody into it because it's not for everybody. But those of you who listen to your show who think home ownership might be, I just will highly encourage them to just start the process by asking a question. Start to get the education. Start to look at your personal situation. Doesn't cost you anything to do that. And what the lesson you learn is, maybe I am ready. I had a workshop in Dallas, Texas, where we had a Hispanic couple come in who didn't realize they were able to buy. Not only were they able to buy, they found out they were qualified for $15,000 in grant monies that day. Today, they moved in. It's two music teachers from the public school system with a three-month-old baby going to celebrate the holidays in their first home now. So, again, you don't know sometimes until you start the process, and don't let fear stop you. People think that today's interest rates, if they're 6%, 6.5%, oh, that's too high. My first house, John, I bought it was at 14%. That's what rates were at that point in time. It's never a bad time to be a first-time home buyer because you can always refinance.
Besides your involvement at Wells Fargo, I also understand that you served on the Freddie Mac Affordable Housing Council. Talk to us about that.
Yeah, you know, Freddie Mac is one of our partners in the fight for equitable housing. I've been on their advisory council. I've been on many boards for housing entities in the D.C. metropolitan area, and some having national responsibility. Being able to work with those partners allows me to help shape policy, to help influence direction of new mortgage programs, and it also helps connect these financial service entities with the rulemakers. And again, I started this conversation talking about we've got to have change in policy. We've got to continue to evolve the environment that governs mortgage processes. The mortgage business is highly regulated. And when we create programs, when we create outlets for mortgages, that's a secondary market. The more outlets we have for secondary execution, the more opportunities you'll have for primary mortgage products to be successful, thus creating a liquidity play. And I hope I didn't confuse a lot of people there, but the reality is you've got to have a cyclical cycle. When you make mortgages, you've got to sell the mortgages to get that money to make more mortgages. That's where we have entities like Freddie Mac come into play. And having a seat at the table, it allows us to exchange information on understanding what we're seeing from consumer needs, what we're seeing from risk characteristics, and how we can continue to grow mortgage production through the creation of new programs.
Being an advisory to some of these programs, what would you like to see coming down the pike in the next 5 to 10 years?
Oh, man. I don't know if I'm prepared for that question, John. You know, I'd like to see a continuance of the investment in helping underserved customers. I'd like to see the focus on the development of affordable housing. I mean, our housing inventory is one of the biggest problems right now. We just don't have enough desirable affordable housing. There may be some affordable housing, but it may not be desirable. So ensuring that we have access to, you know, maybe creative restorative programs. Maybe we have programs that have streamlined refinance opportunities for customers who sit in a mortgage at a rate that's a little higher. Maybe we have innovative streamlined processes that can get customers through a process and get them refinanced quicker to get them at a lower rate. We think about home buying as kind of the big picture, and it is a big purchase. It's the biggest purchase most of us make. But the home buying process actually only lasts 60, 90, 120 days, whatever that time frame is for you to get prepared, buy your home, and settle. Home ownership lasts forever. So once you get in the house, you got to keep the house. So I like to see, you know, the continuance of post-purchase counseling. I like to see some innovation in the refinance space, and I like to see that we do more to put things like digital wills and education on heirs' properties in front of first-time home buyers, because the last thing you want to do is see a family lose a home that they might inherit because they don't know how to take care of it. They don't know that I inherited a home, but I still have to take care of the mortgage. They don't know that I inherited a home, but I may have to pay property taxes. So, you know, that's a whole other conversation we could have. We talk about buying a home, but the biggest challenge sometimes is keeping the home.
One question I want to ask before we run out of time. I've been seeing commercials on television talking about taking equity out of the home without having to refinance the mortgage. How does that work?
So you can get a home equity loan, which is a fixed term and a fixed rate, where some places have a HELOC, which is a home equity line of credit, which is basically a line of credit that's approved like a checkbook. You get $50,000, you can write the loan to yourself when you want to need it. What that really does is you're allowed to take the equity out of your home up to a certain percentage. And I'm going to use easy numbers for the math. Let's assume your house is worth $100,000 and you want to get an equity loan and you owe $60,000 on your home. Often there'll be a LTV maximum. So the bank may say, well, you can get an 80% total loan to value.
Chuck Bishop, Senior Vice President, Head of Diverse Segments, Wells Fargo Home Lending. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions as to your future In Black America programs, email us at inblackamerica@kut.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook and X. You can hear previous programs online at kut.org. Also, you can listen to a special collection of In Black America programs at American Archive of Public Broadcasting. That's AmericanArchives.org. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. Until we have the opportunity again for technical producer David Alvarez, I'm Johnny O. Hansen, Jr. Thank you for joining us today. Please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. That's In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. This has been a production of KUT Radio.
But we begin tonight with January 6th, today's date, which used to hold an unremarkable place on the political calendar. The ceremonial day when every 4 years Congress certifies the foregoing presidential election. Certification day remained unremarkable for 245 years, a mere formality that barely anyone noticed until 2021, when Donald Trump, having been tossed out of the presidency by 81 million voters following a failed first term that included a million COVID deaths and a recession, refused to accept being fired by the American people and instead, embarrassed by having lost to Joe Biden, lied to his enraged and disappointed supporters, telling them he hadn't lost at all, that the election had been stolen from him and from them by various phantoms, illegal immigrant voters, black and brown voters in swing state big cities, diabolical Democrats, the deep state, the voting machines themselves, and maybe even the ghost of Hugo Chavez. And with that big lie, Trump summoned his most ardent supporters to the Capitol.
We're going to walk down to the Capitol. And we're going to cheer on our brave senators and congressmen and women. And we're probably not going to be cheering so much for some of them. Because you'll never take back our country with weakness. You have to show strength and you have to be strong. And we fight. We fight like hell. And if you don't fight like hell, you're not going to have a country anymore.
The president say something to the effect of, you know, I don't effing care that they have weapons. They're not here to hurt me.
I couldn't believe my eyes. There were officers on the ground. You know, they were bleeding. They were throwing up. They were, you know, they had, I saw friends with blood all over their faces. I was slipping in people's blood.
And from that day on, after more than 4 hours of hell, in which Trump sat in the White House watching on TV and throwing ketchup at the wall, as mobs of his supporters sacked the Capitol, injuring police officers, five of whom would wind up dead, alongside multiple Trump fans, one of whom got trampled by the mob and another shot by a police officer while trying to force her way into the speaker's lounge where terrified Congress members and young staffers were hiding. From that day on, this became the lasting memory and meaning of January 6th. This officer standing at the top of the stairs, tricking the mob into going left instead of right where the Congress members were hiding. This officer was trapped in a doorway, screaming for his life. These senators evacuating, fleeing for their lives, including this Missouri Republican, Josh Hawley, who you see circled, who just hours before fleeing in terror was throwing his fist up to the crowd like he was one of them. These Republican members cowering behind the House chamber door under the protection of a Capitol Police officer whose service they would later refuse to honor with votes in favor of congressional gold medals because they feared it would anger their Trumpy base. And these images, the so-called QAnon shaman and his fellow goons taking over the Senate chamber, a highly restricted area to the public, including this guy who brought zip ties. And this old man who ransacked then Speaker Nancy Pelosi's office and then took a seat in her chair with his dirty feet up on her desk. This still unarrested person who left pipe bombs outside the Democratic and Republican committee headquarters. And of course, the noose the insurrectionists brought with them to Washington to hang Vice President Mike Pence with, over his refusal to commit a federal crime by pretending that Trump's fake electors were real and the real electors were invalid.
Bring him out!
Bring out Pence!
Bring him out!
Bring out Pence!
Bring him out!
Bring out Pence!
This is January 6th. From that day forward, and pretending that this is no longer what today means is, to put it bluntly, an insult to every cop that was injured that day, every terrified congressional staffer and member, every Capitol worker who had to clean up the feces the Trump mob smeared on the walls, and to every decent notion anyone ever had about this country. It's also a lie. It's a lie most Republicans and even some in the media want to tell you because it makes Republicans feel better. And apparently making Republicans feel better is really important. Since while their elected officials hid in terror with every single Democrat, the party itself very quickly changed their minds, led by Trump and their favorite billionaire news channel, Rupert Murdoch's Fox. They created a new big lie that January 6th was just a normal tourist occasion and really not that big of a deal. Well, you know what? Sorry, but it was a big deal. It was an insurrection, the first violent sacking of our Capitol since the War of 1812. Trump's second impeachment was literally for the incitement of an insurrection. And the idea of forgetting that, of just moving on and pretending there's no harm, no foul, and preparing to quietly reinstall the chief insurrectionist without comment, is frankly a shameful idea. The fact that so few voters found his actions disqualifying, the Supreme Court conservatives' negation of the Constitution's insurrection clause so our shameless Chief Justice John Roberts could clear the way for his reelection, all of it is, sorry, utterly shameful. Today is not a day to commemorate. Yes, we've got to do it because that's what some of y'all voted for or failed to vote and cleared the way for, but for God's sakes, let's at least have the decency and dignity to be a little embarrassed. Embarrassed for the most cynical of political parties, for their supposed dear leader, for his billionaire bosses who paid to reinstall him, and for anyone who dismissed January 6, 2021 as not a deal breaker for the man for whom the violence occurred to be president again. You do realize the rest of the world can see us, right? And 14 days from today, you will hear many soberly and reverently laud the peaceful transfer of power. Well, I hate to be the fly at the picnic table, but you can't peacefully transfer power to an insurrectionist simply because it took them an extra 4 years to finish the job. This was a violent transfer of power, the most violent in U.S. history, if we're being honest. Joining me now is Congressman Benny Thompson of Mississippi, former chair of the January 6th Select Committee and ranking member of the Committee on Homeland Security. Congressman, it is wonderful to see you. And I want to give you an opportunity. You have just heard what I think about today, and I would like for you to tell us how you feel on today.
Well, obviously, what you saw today is how the process is supposed to work. The certification is a formality that's required. The vice president is supposed to preside. And obviously, the results are the results. Well, 4 years ago, that was not the case. Former President Trump invited people to come to Washington and told them it would be wild. And so when that occurred, and a lot of us were involved in it, it became crystal clear that we have to fix this. So Congress directed the formation of the January 6th Select Committee to look at the facts and circumstances. And for almost 2 years, we did that. We produced a report. Some people didn't like the report, but Joy, it stands for itself. Now, if those individuals who had a problem with it could have come forth during our work, they could have testified, but they had to do it on the oath. AFTA is who they are now. What they are saying has no significance whatsoever in our work product. So I can tell you what people saw with their own eyes really happened. I can tell you that Donald Trump made the inquiry for people to come. And I can tell you that the work of our committee stands on its own. And so here we are 4 years later. Our democracy survived. Part of that survival is a lot of us are committed, even in losing an election, to do it the right way. And so I said in the halls today, Jamie Raskin and myself, I'm wearing the tie that I wore 4 years ago when all this craziness occurred. But it's still the symbol of democracy. We have to go with it. It is a sin and shame that Donald Trump is trying to rewrite history. It was a bad day. I don't care what he says. It's a black mark on this country. And what we have to do, Joy, is get it right. And getting it right is not retribution on the part of those people you don't like. This is a democracy. And Donald Trump has to understand it's more than just who he is. We are a nation of laws. We're not a nation of what one thinks. And so as a black man from Mississippi, I understand when government is used against its own people. It took my United States government, the free people who look like Benny Thompson, to have the right to vote. So I look for my government to do what's right, not what people think should be. And so Donald Trump has to grow up. He has to be the adult. He's a commander in chief, and he needs to move in that direction.
Anyone who's in the sound of my voice, the January 6th rioters are getting off easy. Privilege. Lawmakers from both sides of the political aisle have denounced the storming of the Capitol as an act of domestic terrorism. But 4 years after the insurrection, prosecutors have rarely asked judges to impose the harsh sentences that federal law recommends for defendants motivated by politics. It has a political motivation. What is that? It's the same type of charges for the man in New Orleans. It's the same type of charges for Oklahoma City. It's the same charges with the ism, TERRORISM. That's what it should be. But you guys are so concerned about, oh my gosh, from overseas and the foreign and the Muslims. What about the homegrown ones right in your backyard with the MAGA hats? Instead, even as some judges have publicly debated whether the charges against January 6 defendants qualify as crimes of terrorism, prosecutors have repeatedly pulled back on tougher sentences, citing unspecified facts and circumstances. The sentencing enhancement for terrorism crimes was created as a result of legislation Congress passed following the 1993 boom in the parking, I have to be careful of the algorithm, in the parking garage at the World Trade Center. The provision initially applied only to crimes linked to international T-word. But after the bombing of the Oklahoma, after the boom of the Oklahoma City federal building in 1995, Congress moved to expand the enhancement to cover the T-word inspired purely by domestic causes. The biggest form of the T-word is domestic, homegrown, right-wing, radicalized, white nationalist, white men mostly. That is according to the head of the FBI, who is a Republican Donald Trump appointee, Christopher Wray. Terrorism-related language now includes federal criminal offenses calculated to influence or affect the conduct of government by intimidation or coercion, or to retaliate against government conduct. Sounds like it to me. Does it sound like it to you? Obviously, January 6th qualifies as domestic terrorism, and yet the DOJ is not prosecuting cases, by the way. Cases that way, I should say. And that is a big deal. Invoking those enhancements typically adds about 15 years in prison to defendant's recommended sentence, setting the minimum calculation at 17 and a half years. Merrick Garland, the Biden Justice Department, letting off January 6th insurrectionist terrorists with lower sentencing, lower charges. They should, the minimum of 17 and a half years. That's why I say they should rot in prison. But oh my God, they're being overcharged and the Biden Justice Department is, the Biden Justice Department is letting these people off easy. Do you think that a Trump Justice Department would have done that for black and brown people if they were Democrats doing the same thing? White privilege again, once again. Don't get me started. Don't get me started. And people are afraid to say that. That's exactly what this is. But somehow, people of a certain hue can do things, and it's not considered unpatriotic. It's not considered the T word. It's not considered treason. I'm going to play a short timeline. I'm going to play some of it on what happened on that day, because I want you to know. I want you to watch it. I want you to watch it. Here it is.
I am not allowed to say what's going to happen today, because everyone's just going to have to watch.
Yeah, this was organic, right? I'm not allowed. This is organic.
Something's going to happen.
Thank you.
Who breathes our streets? Who breathes our streets?
I hope Mike is going to do the right thing. I hope so. I hope so. Because if Mike Pence does the right thing, we win the election. All Vice President Pence has to do is send it back to the states to recertify, and we become president, and you are the happiest people. Mike Pence is going to have to come through for us, and if he doesn't, that will be a sad day for our country.
Because you'll never take back our country with weakness. You have to show strength, and you have to be strong.
USA! 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 USA!
Cruiser 50. It does look like we're going to have an ad hoc march stepping off here. There's a crowd surge heading east.
We love Trump! 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 We love Trump!
Mike Pence, I hope you're going to stand up for the good of our Constitution and for the good of our country. And if you're not, I'm going to be very disappointed in you. I will tell
Remember,
you right
Mike Pence is an evangelical that they chose to be on the ticket to win over evangelicals. And now all of a sudden they said that he was a traitor and they wanted to hang him. Oh, this is not. Look at 12:54 p.m. This is peace. This is supposed to be a peace circle. This is what they call a peace circle. Look at this. How peaceful is this? Is this peaceful to you? Don't you believe this is peaceful? Now imagine if these were black and brown people. Remember how Fox News and all of those, they had the invasions coming across the border, right? Pictures like this of people walking towards the southern border. Now imagine if this were black and brown people, what would happen? It would not be, look how peaceful this is. Look at this walk in the park.
Madam Speaker,
if you're joining us on, I see you guys on the TikTok. We're on YT. You can see all of it with a timeline on the tube. At 1 p.m., they tried to come in to certify the election. And guess what was happening outside? Police officers were being beaten to within an inch of their lives by MAGA idiots. Oh, look, breaking through barricades. Oh, peaceful.
They're trying to breach and get to the Capitol.
Walk in the park. We're playing it all out for you. We're on the tube on YT if you want to join us. But make sure you smash the screen here.
42.
Yes, this is live. From my new ass on YouTube, on TikTok. 206. Oh, look, women in the crowd. Oh, look at them. Throwing objects at police officers. Traffic cones, flags. Thank you, Janelle. Thank you for pinning it to the top. That's where you go if you want to watch this live. Look, oh, they're breaking into the Capitol. They're breaking the windows and they have shields.
Breach of the Capitol.
Be advised, they're requesting additional resources on the east side as they've broken into that window and they're trying to kick it in.
Oh, they're trying to kick it in. These are peaceful. Oh, they were being ushered in, but they had to break windows.
Without objection, the chair declares the House in recess pursuant to Clause 12B of Rule 1.
The House had to recess at 2:18 p.m. because of this. Donald Trump tweeting, Mike Pence didn't have the courage to do what should have been done to protect our country and our Constitution. Not saying stop it, he's tweeting out, encouraging them. Yes, is this the day of love? They want to ask, they're asking to bring out Pence so they can do what? They're trying to hang him. There's a gallows out there. Look, there's a gallows. There's a noose. Well, where did they get that noose idea? Isn't it interesting? Oh, especially white people, let's be honest, always want to hang people. Anybody else get the notion? Never heard a black person saying, I want to hang somebody. Right, let's be honest, have you? Why do they always want to hang people? What is with that? The history of lynching in this country? That's their comfort zone. Now they're, whose house? Our house. Why? The election was completely legitimate by every court in the land, including the highest court, which is a conservative court, the Supreme Court. And yet and still, Donald Trump and MAGA, Donald Trump is lying to MAGA, and they are buying it because they are what? Cultists. Dig, Doug, whatever. No, I did not. Get your facts straight. You guys are so ignorant. People are so ignorant. The MAGA people are so ignorant about facts. And lately, not like Republicans in general, but especially the MAGA folks, you guys are just dumb. Now they're beating up police officers. This is Michael Fanone, officer. That's his body cam.
They're all walking over now through the tunnels.
Being beaten up. Had a heart attack. Samantha Pruitt says, white privilege being shown at its best, shaking my head. This is true.
We need to hold the doors of the Capitol.
Look at him. Oh, look, in a fight with a police officer, back the blue, MAGA, idiots, fighting police officers, yet they back the blue. It's all hypocrisy and lies. Oh, look how they're kicking this police officer's ass. Oh, my gosh, poor officer. So much anger and hate in their hearts. Why is that? Because they think that they should be what? Prioritized and be the preeminent voice. That is supremacy. And they are white. White supremacy. That's what this is. That's what Donald Trump is playing on. Their fears that they, just like anybody else, have to have an equal station in America. They want to be prioritized. Our house. Imagine the privilege of that. Imagine the entitlement of that. Now, because seriously, as I look at this, imagine if these were black and brown people. Now they're going into House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's office.
So they want you to see. Capitol Police is going to start moving their resources inside.
Oh, did you see him throwing garbage cans at police officers? Now they want you to think, they want you to forget about this every year, but we're going to remind them every year of their own violence. And barbary. And how uncivil
with four members.
They act.
There's people.
Thank you, 32 Antoine.
We have no way out.
We have no way out. Officers were saying, I can't believe today Congress is going to certify the election of a president that was involved in an insurrection, asking for 11,780 votes, fake elector scheme, hasn't conceded to this day. Scary times. This is true.
It's up to us people now, the American people.
What are you ready to do?
One more time.
What are you ready to do?
And whatever it takes, I'll lay my life down if it takes.
That's how people have been brainwashed. Give me a little more volume, Andy, if you have it on the screen. We're coming in. Aren't these the people, F you, they're saying to police? Aren't these the people who say, hey, why didn't they just comply? Why aren't they complying with police officers here? It's hypocrisy. Why aren't they complying with police officers? You tell me. Because they don't think that they have to? Officer down. Don't, do not forget about this, people. Nothing but white supremacy. I can't watch again. Peggy McGeary, you have to watch.
They were peaceful people. These were great people.
Donald Trump, they're peaceful.
Unbelievable, and I mentioned the word love, the love in the air. I've never seen anything like it.
That, how could Trump look at this footage and still say that it was a day of peace? He's delusional. They're delusional. I agree with you. How could this person be president again? This is the Vice President of the United States saying that there's a constitutional duty. And this is why Democrats are different in this moment than Republicans. Here it is.
Peaceful transfer of power is one of the most fundamental principles of American democracy. As much as any other principle, it is what distinguishes our system of government from monarchy or tyranny. Today at the United States Capitol, I will perform my constitutional duty as Vice President of the United States to certify the results of the 2024 election. This duty is a sacred obligation, one I will uphold, guided by love of country, loyalty to our Constitution, and my unwavering faith in the American people. As we have seen, our democracy can be fragile, and it is up to then each one of us to stand up for our most cherished principles and to make sure that in America, our government always remains of the people, by the people, and for the people. May God bless you, and may God bless the United States of America.
Wow. American patriot, Vice President of the United States, doing the right thing, as Mike Pence did, as a matter of fact, back in January of 2020. Same thing. He did his patriotic duty and the duty that he was supposed to do as the Vice President of the United States. And now Vice President Kamala Harris is going to do the same thing today.
Just a reflection of years past. Thanks for listening, everyone.
We don't want you on our team. You're too slow and fat.
This is weight bias.
Don't you care how you look?
Those with the serious disease called obesity face weight bias every day.
You're not the right fit for this job.
And blame themselves.
I wish I was different.
Weight bias hurts.
Let's stop weight bias. Be part of the solution.
Go to stopweightbias.com. A public service message from Obesity Action Coalition.
The future depends on teachers. Every day, teachers are shaping our tomorrows, starting their students on journeys that will change the course of history. Right now, in a classroom somewhere in the United States, there's a teacher inspiring a future scientist who will make preventing pandemics their life's work, sharpening the mind of an aspiring environmentalist who will help combat climate change, and generating possibilities for a student who will be the first in their family to graduate college. It all starts with teachers who meet challenges with creativity, who reinvent education for the future, who work towards a school system that lifts up every child, regardless of race, income, or zip code, and to enable the full potential of our students, our communities, and our country. Explore a career that leaves a legacy you can be proud of. Shape the future. Teach. Learn more and receive free support at teach.org.
Hello, I'm Kevin Jameson, volunteer and president of the Dementia Society of America. Please request our free guide filled with facts about dementia. Go to 1-800-DEMENTIA.org or call 1-800-DEMENTIA. Thank you.
Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT, its members, or Carnegie Mellon University. Email questions or comments to pa@wrct.org.
Hello, you're listening to Forbes Avenue on WRCT Pittsburgh 88.3 FM. I'm your host, Arshan Das, with my co-host,
Kate Smiggy.
And today we're going to be interviewing Max Gonzalez, also known as Gems.
Hi.
Max is a graffiti artist and muralist in Pittsburgh. He has a pretty interesting story, so I guess we'll let him lead it off. Tell us how you got into graffiti.
So I am a full-time muralist, but I always make the distinction to say that I'm, like, first and foremost a graffiti writer. I have a very, like, graffiti, like, traditional hip-hop lettering background. I'm originally from Southwest Side Chicago. I grew up painting there and just, like, seeing, like, graffiti everywhere I was from, because the neighborhood I'm from is Pilsen, and it's just, like, this very historic Chicano community that's just covered in graffiti. So I just naturally saw it everywhere I was. So even, like, as far as, like, starting to draw graffiti, like, I don't even know how old I was, because I just was mimicking what I saw and what I thought graffiti was. I very much so have always had graffiti in my life. I didn't really start to, like, try to actually paint and get a name in graffiti until I was about, like, 15. I think, like, the first time I used spray paint, though, I was, like, 13, just coming from, like, a construction background and doing vandal-type things with my dad and my brother. And, yeah, from there, around, like, later in high school is when I started to actually really try to push it more, try to do pieces and things. But it really was when I moved to Pittsburgh for college and didn't have, like, parental control and kind of had free reign that I really, really started to push graffiti. So that was, like, age 18. I started writing Gems. Before that, I was writing all kinds of other things, but Gems is, like, really what stuck out to me. And just, like, being in a university format in a city that was unfamiliar to me and just kind of hating the college format I was in, I kind of didn't like to hang around a lot. So every night I would just go paint on things and put my name everywhere. So in a way, like me having graffiti was an access to like my upbringing to Chicago and kind of like that culture that I was brought up with. So being able to like export that to Pittsburgh and like pull from that inspiration. But yeah, so the whole time through college, I was not doing graffiti as my art form for Carnegie Mellon, but it was still always there.
Yeah, so you studied at Carnegie Mellon, like we are current Carnegie Mellon students. A lot of times when you're around campus, you hear people talking about how the environment here is somewhat depressing or suffocating. Everyone has their own opinions on that, but how do you think the environment of Pittsburgh and Carnegie Mellon contributed to your art?
Yeah, if anything, it was kind of good that I had such a distaste for CMU, just because it forced me to seek like the actual Pittsburgh communities outside of the campus areas. Just because, I don't know, like coming from where I'm from, like I'm not poor or anything, but I come from a working class family and like work construction my whole life. So coming here and like even during school, like working two different jobs, like working at a restaurant and then like working construction during the summers, like I just couldn't really culturally attach myself to a lot of the other people here, where I was just seeing people who literally princes and princesses, and I was just kind of like, oh my god, and like children of like CEOs, and it just like was very difficult for me to attach myself to that, especially coming from like Chicago and kind of loving the more city nitty gritty side of things. But yeah, so that did push me to eventually start looking into seeing the rest of the East End. So really, I've always like prided myself on like being very attached to the East End of Pittsburgh. So like East Liberty, Bloomfield, Garfield. From there, finding places like Time Bomb Shop, which used to be on Highland Ave, which is like a historic hip-hop graffiti store, and Daily Bread, and finding all those friends there. Thank you to CMU for pushing me away.
I think it's sometimes great on artistic journeys to find inspiration from life and to find inspiration sometimes from those struggles that you face. And I feel like that's the uncomfortable part of the artistic journey. But when you're creating graffiti, what are you thinking about in terms of style and colors? Like, what do those artistic choices look like? Or do you come up with a design beforehand? Or
yeah, I mean, I would say there's definitely a distinction for me between like my graffiti and my muralism or spray can muralism. As far as graffiti inspiration, like letters, a lot of the inspiration for me does come from Pittsburgh. It wasn't until I moved to Pittsburgh that I had people who were willing to critique my style and tell me like that I sucked for the first time. And I was like, oh, wow, like I just assumed because I know how to draw, I must be good at graffiti. And it's kind of like, well, no, like graffiti is a typographic art form. It's based in lettering and this long history of hip hop. It even predates hip hop. And so I can't reinvent something that's already been mastered and that has this super strong history tied to it. It'd be wrong for me to reject the culture that it comes from young black and brown kids from New York and Philadelphia. Yeah, so I'm always looking to that as a reference point, like original subway graffiti, just wall graffiti. As far as like what I'm contributing to my style writing, and even in my murals, I try to push for there to be as much of a graffiti presence as possible. So any point that I get to introduce traditional graffiti styles into my art, I'd gladly accept it.
It's interesting that you mentioned the different scenes that exist in graffiti from different cities. I wanted to ask you, what are some of the regional differences that exist between what you saw in, say, Chicago and here in Pittsburgh? And how does that influence your style?
Yeah, there absolutely is like a huge distinction between different cities' graffiti styles. Like I even said, like there's a little bit of a contention between who started modern style writing, whether it was Philadelphia or New York, but they both started around the same time in the late 60s. Philadelphia has a very, very distinct style for their like very tall, elongated letters. Even all of their like pieces look like that. It's called a style called Wickeds. And it's just like this very, very gestural style that you probably couldn't even read if you weren't from Philadelphia. Where New York is known for like these rounder, more funky styles. Yeah, so and even being that Philadelphia, Pittsburgh, they're in the same state, yes, they're opposite ends, it's just interesting to note that Pittsburgh does not have a Philadelphia style. Pittsburgh has a bit of his own style, kind of with the advent of Instagram and the internet, styles have started to be diluted a bit. Philadelphia still has its style, but all the styles are kind of meshing a lot. The one thing with Chicago's style is that it actually kind of is very similar to LA's style because of a history of a Chicano and Cholo movement there, where a lot of the original graffiti from LA is